Today I'm going to tell you about some joint work that I've done with my advisor, Franz Kasuk. As soon as the slides come up. Oh. That would explain why the slides aren't up. All right. So this talk is going to be about DHTs. Many of you probably already know about DHTs, but just to get everyone on the same page, a DHT is a kind of building block for distributed systems. And in a DHT, each node that's participating in the system is responsible for some subset of keys stored into the system. And the DHT provides a primitive where any client in the system can route messages to the node that's responsible for a particular key. Now, it should be very clear how you can build on top of such a primitive a put-get interface, which is why they're called distributed hash tables. Now, in an open context, that is to say, in a DHT in which any node on the internet can join the system, there's a classic attack, an attack called the Sybil attack, which is very difficult to protect against. And the way it works is like this. Imagine that you have a DHT with, say, 10,000 honest nodes. And I'm a bad guy. I want to attack this system. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a million identities, and I might create them by, for example, creating public-private key pairs, and I join the system as normal, and I use my million identities to overwhelm the operation of the system by taking part in it. And whenever a request is sent to one of my identities, I could disrupt it by, for example, dropping the request on the floor, sending bogus responses, or poisoning other nodes' routing tables. Now, this is a very difficult attack to protect against, but even if there is some way of limiting the number of Sybil identities in the DHT, it turns out that there is a variant of this attack where the attacker can choose all of his node's identifiers to fall within a very small range of keys in the system. Now, this means that if someone makes a request for a key that's in that range, it's still possible for the attacker to interfere with those requests. And as a result, it's going to be possible for the attacker to target particular keys. Now, the Sybil attack was identified very shortly after DHTs were invented. And since that time, there's actually been a whole lot of different work on trying to address the Sybil attack. And I'm not going to get into the details of what those different papers are about, but more generally, they all assume that you're going to have some sort of centralized gatekeeper whose role it is to limit the number of Sybil identities in the system and to ensure that Sybil identities have random IDs. The work that I'm going to present to you today is going to be a new DHT called Vano. Vano is a Maori word that means family. And the Vano protocol is going to be a highly efficient one-hop DHT. It's going to be asymptotically equal in performance to an insecure one-hop DHT. But it has the great feature that its behavior is going to be totally irrespective of the number of Sybil identities in the system. So I want to be very clear on what Vano provides and what Vano does not provide. Vano assumes that it's part of a system in which another layer of the system is going to provide integrity for key value pairs. That is to say, you can imagine that key value pairs are signed by something, and so that if you hand me a bogus key value pair or a bogus value for a key that I've requested, I can tell that it's not the right value. Vano is going to provide availability for the system. And what that means is that with high probability, if I retry my lookup a few times, it's extremely likely that Vano is going to return the good value associated with the key. So all I need to do is keep on trying it. I throw out the bogus responses, and then I finally accept when I receive a valid response. Now, Vano uses two main approaches to address the two main problems that I laid out before. It uses a social network, as in previous work, to limit the number of Sybil identities in the system or in routing tables. And we also introduce a new technique, which we called layered identifiers, and that addresses the clustering attack that I talked about a moment ago. Let's step back for a moment. The Vano protocol is divided conceptually into two phases, a setup phase and a lookup phase. We assume that whenever an application wants to insert a key value pair into the DHT, that's going to go into a local put queue that's on that node. And then when the setup phase runs, it's going to take that whole set of put queues as input, and it's also going to take a social network between nodes as inputs. And setup is going to run a distributed protocol over all the nodes in the system. The output of that distributed protocol is going to be a set of highly redundant and highly structured routing tables. Then, in the lookup phase, we're not going to look directly at the social network or the put queues. We're going to ignore those, but we're going to use the routing tables to route requests from keys to values. Now, right now, I'm going to look at the social network in more detail, and we'll return to what the routing tables look like in a few slides. So I want to give you an idea for what I mean when I say social network. It means different things to different people. So imagine you have two people, they've met in a bar, and they want to keep in touch with each other, so they pull out their mobile devices, and their mobile devices, using some sort of physical rendezvous, exchange keys with each other and create address book entries for each other. Now the two people later on go home, and later on their devices are going to keep track of each other over the internet. So they're going to maintain that an open connection. Now if we consider, step back and consider all the set of connections created in that way, that's what I call a social network. Now it may be that there are adversarial identities in this social network as well, and the adversary can structure his part of the social network however he wants. We don't assume any limit on the size of the Sybil region or on its structure. However, in order to create a link between a bad identity, a Sybil identity, and a good identity, the bad guy actually has to go around and walk around in bars and get people to connect with him. So it's going to require some amount of work to create these attack edges. Now, if we have a social network with this kind of property, we can use a technique from the Sybil Limit paper of random walks. Now, basically, imagine that you're starting at some arbitrary honest node and you take a few steps on the social network. And then you record the node that's at the end of that random walk. Now, if you do this process in parallel a large number of times and collect the whole set of nodes that return by those random walks, that set is going to have some pretty good properties. One property it's going to have, it's going to be a fairly mixed sample of nodes from the social network. And the other good property that it's going to have is that the set of nodes that are at the end of those random walks is going to be mostly good nodes. So there's going to be a fairly limited fraction of bad nodes in routing tables that we construct using this random walk primitive. And more importantly, that fraction of bad nodes is actually totally independent of the size and structure of the Sybil region. It depends only on the number of attack edges in the social network. Now again, I want to step back. We're going to look at the structure of the routing tables, and then we're going to go into how we build the routing tables using the social network. So I'm going to tell you about what the routing tables are going to look like at the end of the process, and then I'll tell you how they're built. So at each node, there is two tables. There's a finger table, and there's what we call a key table. Each of them is going to be of size approximately square root of n, where n is the number of keys stored into the system. Now, the key table of a node consists of pointers to other nodes participating in the system. And they're going to be distributed, their IDs are going to be distributed uniformly over the set of keys in the system. The key table of a node is going to consist of the square root of n keys that immediately follow that node's ID in the key space. Now, if you think about it, consider the set of key tables stored by all of a particular node's fingers. Because they're distributed, because their starting points are distributed uniformly over the key space, and they're very compact, it's going to be the case that that whole, the union of all those sets, is going to cover all the key value pairs in the entire system. So it should be pretty clear at this point how you could do lookups using routing tables like this. You know, for example, if I want to route a message to the key canes, then I'm going to find the finger with ID that's closest to the target key, and I'll send a request to that finger. And it's very likely that that finger is going to have the target key in its own key table. So it can just reply with the associated value. Now, it should also be pretty clear how we can use the random walk primitive to build a finger table like this. Because if we take, say, square root of n parallel random walks and just collect the set of nodes at the end of those random walks and ask them for their own IDs, which are randomly chosen from the set of keys, what we're going to get out at the end is a table that consists of pointers to a random sample of nodes, mostly honest, which are going to be uniformly distributed around the key space. Now, there's a similar but somewhat more complicated procedure for building the key tables, and I'm going to leave the details of that to the paper. But the point to remember is that in both of those tables, the fraction of dishonest entries is going to be a minority. It's going to be a small fraction. Now, the IDs chosen by honest nodes are uniformly chosen from the set of keys in the system, so they're very well distributed around the ring. So if you look at a typical honest node's finger table, it's going to look like this. The honest entries in that finger table are going to be spread uniformly around the ring, and if I want to reach this target key, I have plenty of options of fingers to send my message to send my query to. However, the Sybil participants are not constrained to choosing their IDs the same way as the honest participants do. So if we assume that half of the routing table, of the finger table, consists of Sybil IDs, the bad guy could attack a particular key by choosing all of his IDs to fall within a very small range preceding that key. Now, what's going to happen if I try to route to that green key? What's going to happen is I'm going to look at my finger table and I'll say, well, there are a lot of nodes that I could send a query to that all seem close enough to the target key, but I don't know which one to send my message to. Now, if I choose one at random and query it, it's very likely that I'll be querying a bad node, and then I won't get a good response. I'll get bogus data or no response. However, I have no way of distinguishing between the bad nodes and the good nodes, so I can't use some process to try to only send my message to the blue nodes on this picture. I need to avoid sending messages to the red nodes. So what do we do? Well, our technique for solving this is, imagine that you replicate this whole structure that I told you about, both the key tables and the finger tables, and let's just imagine that we have two such replicas, which we'll call layers, layer 0 and layer 1. And layer 0 is going to be constructed in precisely the same way that I just described to you. That is to say, honest nodes are going to pick their IDs randomly from the set of keys, and evil nodes are going to pick their IDs arbitrarily, so they might cluster their IDs. However, in layer 1, honest nodes are going to pick their IDs using a completely different technique. If I'm an honest node and I want to pick my layer 1 ID, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at my own layer 0 finger table. And I'm going to pick a random entry from my own layer 0 finger table, and I'm going to use its ID as my layer 1 ID. That should be a little bit counterintuitive, because I just said that half of the IDs in the finger table are actually bad nodes. that means that with 50% probability, I'm actually letting the bad guy choose my layer 1 ID for me. How can this possibly help? Well, on the level of a single honest node, it has no effect. There's no sense in which a single honest node is benefited by this. But if you consider the aggregate behavior of all the honest nodes, the aggregate effect of this is that if the bad guys cluster in a particular region, then the good nodes are also going to tend to cluster in exactly the same region. Now, how does this help us? Well, the bad guy can continue to cluster in the same region, but now look at layer 1. Say I want to route a request to a key in that range. Now what happens if I pick a likely-looking finger at random? Well, now there's a rough balance between the number of honest identifiers and the number of Sybil identifiers in my finger table that could answer my query. So if I just pick one at random and send my query to it, I have a good probability that I'm actually going to be sending my request to an honest finger, and that honest finger is going to be able to answer my quest correctly. So that's great. But of course, there's a little bit of a catch, because the bad guy can outthink us. He can say, well, I know that if I cluster in layer 0, then the good guys are necessarily also going to cluster in layer 1. So what I'll do is I'm going to lay in wait. I'm going to not cluster in layer 0, and then the good guys won't cluster in layer 1, and then I'll cluster in layer 1. So it's true. Now if I try to query for a key in this range in layer 1, I would, again, fail. I'd tend to get a whole lot of bad fingers before I ever reached a good finger. But by assumption, we just assumed that in layer 0, the bad guy didn't cluster. So all that means is that what I can do is pick one of the layers at random. Pick layer 0, flip a coin, 50-50 chance, pick layer 0 or pick layer 1, and use that layer to do my lookup. So that decreases my probability of getting a good node by 50%, but that's okay. Just do twice as many queries in parallel. Just a constant factor. Now, there is one more additional catch before I go on, and that's that the bad guy can do a sort of subtler version of the laying in wait approach. So imagine that the bad guy has 100 IDs to play around with. What he can do is he could just cluster 10 of those IDs in layer 0, and then that will elicit a sort of weak response by the good guys in layer 1. But then on layer 1, I really go all in. So as a result, the bad guy gets out of this a 10-to-1 ratio of bad IDs to good IDs in each layer. And that's not ideal. So the fix for this is actually quite simple. It's just to use log n parallel layers. And the paper has a clear explanation of why log n is the right number. But that basically bumps down the amount of power the adversary can get out of such an approach. So just to summarize how lookup works in Vano, each node is going to have log n parallel IDs, and we're going to have log n parallel replicas of the finger tables and key tables. And in order to do a lookup, first I'm going to flip a coin and pick a random layer to do the lookup in, and then I'm going to look at the part of the ring that's part of the finger table that's near the target key, and pick a finger randomly from the set of ones that might know about my key value pair. And if that fails, then retry from step one until we succeed. Of course, we could do multiple iterations of this in parallel to ensure that we got our result faster. So, of course, I've just told you about a particular attack, a clustering attack. You might ask if there are other attacks that might break the system. And indeed, there are some attacks on the system that I haven't told you about. But the reason that we trust in its correctness is that we have a proof that if the social network has the good properties I talked about, and if we allocate sufficient amount of resources per each node, sufficiently large routing tables and sufficiently large bandwidth budget, then with very high probability, Vano succeeds in constant time. So, of course, our proof relies on the correctness of certain assumptions about the social network, and we wanted to answer a number of experimental questions about social networks. We identified a number of hypotheses to answer in the paper. I'm going to tell you about the data from two of these today, and any other questions I'll take offline. In order to answer our questions, we built two implementations of Vano. One implementation is a large-scale in-memory simulator, and that abstracts away the details of the network and just counts message counts versus various parameters of the system. The other implementation, which I won't talk about today, but there are details in the paper, is a fully networked implementation that runs on PlanetLab. The attack that we simulated in the simulator is the clustering attack that I've just described to you. It's the best attack that we are aware of. And the data that we pulled out is from a number of sources. Our largest data set had 5 million nodes in it. I'm going to show you data from the Flickr network, which has 2 million nodes in it. So, first question is, does this random walk primitive make any sense? Is that going to have the good results that we want? So, this graph shows on the x-axis the length of the random walk you take starting from an arbitrary honest node. And on the y-axis, it shows the probability that a random walk starting at an arbitrary honest node is going to walk over an attack edge. And the different lines show scenarios with different numbers of attack edges, different attacker powers. So naturally, what you see is that as the number of attack edges increases, the probability of escaping over an attack edge, of course, increases. And as the number of steps you take increases, again, of course, the probability that you're eventually going to walk over an attack edge is going to increase. So knowing those two facts, you might say, well, aha, the correct solution is to choose random walks of length zero. We will never walk over an attack edge, and the protocol will be perfectly secure. But at this point, you probably know why that isn't going to work, because if you take a random walk of length zero, you end up right where you started, and you don't get a very uniform distribution of your finger tables. So there's a measure of this problem. It's called total variation distance, and you should think of it as being like the probability of getting a non-random result by taking a random walk of that length. And I just call it clumpiness as an intuitive thing. And we want clumpiness to be low, and we also want the probability of walking over an attack edge to be low. And there's a trade-off between these two things. And we found for our simulations, a random walk length of length 2 works with a lot of different scenarios. It's not perfectly uniform, but it turns out that Vano is resilient enough that it's uniform enough for it to work very well. So speaking of which, this graph shows you how well Vano performs under these same attack scenarios. So the x-axis of this graph shows you the amount of resources that we allocated to our simulated version of Vano per node. So 10,000 means that there are 10,000 table entries per node in the system. The y-axis shows you the number of messages required for the median lookup request to succeed. So that's the number of retries you had to do. If you made it one try and you got your answer back the first time, that number would be one. If you made two tries and the first try returned bogus data, then the answer would be two. Now, I want to focus your attention on the part of the graph that's to the right of the dotted line, because that's the only part of the graph where our proof says anything about Vano's performance. And secondly, I'd also like to focus your attention on the green, the blue, and the black lines, because again, those are the only situations in which the proof of Vano's correctness actually has any validity. To the extent that Vano works for the red line, that's simply because our proof is relatively conservative. So it's nice to see that it does sometimes work in those cases. Now, just to give you an example, with 200,000 attack edges, and that's a situation in which 15% of honest nodes actually have a connection to the bad guy, Vano takes approximately 10 messages to route any query from any starting node to any target key. And that's with the bare minimum table size. As you can see, if you're willing to allocate a bit more resources, you can bump down the latency a little bit. Now, at this point, I've shown you some data, and I want to step back for a moment and remind everyone that Vano provides its security guarantee, but that security guarantee rests on a critical assumption about the social network, which is that the number of attack edges is relatively small compared to the number of honest nodes in the system. Now, the picture I've shown here does satisfy that requirement, but if instead you had connections from all the honest nodes to a Sybil identity, then Vano wouldn't provide any benefit. So you really have to ask whether a specific social network would have the desired property. So just to wrap everything up and summarize, the protocol I've presented to you, Vano, it uses a social network to filter out the bad nodes in the system. And so it's oblivious to the actual number of identities that the Sybil attacker has. The performance of Vano, ignoring constant factors such as encryption overhead and so on, is actually exactly the same as an insecure one-hop DHT. So it's actually very efficient. And in order to achieve our efficiency and our security guarantees, we introduced a new concept called layers, which combats the trickiest sort of attacks for a DHT to deal with. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Hi, Chris. Your picture, you said, described an arbitrary node. So in some sense, that is more like average case than worst case behavior.
Which picture?
About the length of a random walk you needed to get a sufficient amount of diversity, if I understood
The idea is that you start from an arbitrary honest node.
Right. So I was wondering if, so that seems to be like, if you're using an arbitrary, it seems like that's kind of the average case result you have. I was wondering, if you'd analyze it all the worst case. I mean, if I join the system.
Yes. Right. Okay. So there is a worst case. The worst case is I'm an honest node who has made a lot of connections to bad nodes. And so actually, the proof is going to say that there's an epsilon fraction of nodes which may be very near this sort of a lot of attack edges. And those nodes are not going to have the same performance guarantees as the other nodes in the system.
Right. I guess I was
so
also
the worst case is bad, but it's a small fraction of nodes.
I guess I was asking this, how do you determine, so you were using that to determine what the length of a random walk should be to make it safe. I assume that most of this is basically making some assumption about the graph that it looks like.
Longer random walks aren't going to help. Longer random walks make things less safe.
No, I meant for a given node, I think what you were saying is how long should a given node do a random walk? And so that is making an assumption that the graph kind of looks like some type of an expander, and it has those nice properties you want. So I guess my question is, for a given node, if I join the system, what should I do?
Right. The assumption that we've been operating under is that the length of the random walk is kind of programmed into the system from the outset, and everyone's using the same length of random walk. You could think about a system in which different nodes use different length random walks. It wouldn't help that much because Vano's good behavior is an emergent behavior of all of the nodes in the system. So if I do something differently from everyone else, you know, my performance is going to be highly dependent on how they choose their random walk lengths. So it doesn't really make any sense for any node to, no node is going to really get any benefit for itself by going off and doing its own thing.
Thanks.
So I had a question. To what extent is this idea of layered identifiers tied to your use of a one-hop DHT? So could I do the same thing with core?
With a multi-hop DHT?
Right.
It turns out that a multi-hop DHT is harder to do. And that's because every time you take multiple hops, you know, you imagine that you're making the power of the adversary stronger. You're getting farther and farther away from your own locus in the social network. So it's actually very challenging. The one-hop DHT nature of Vano is actually sort of baked in. It would be very difficult to extend it to a multi-hop system.
Thanks. Any additional questions? Let's thank our speaker once more.